Informed opinions are always presented here. You're locked in with the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
He's Joe Blank. I'm Patrick Creighton for Jeremy Branham. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5. So, all over social media last night, I was seeing ESPN dumped out of the game that they were in to move this to the prime channel on ESPN. And that was Serena and Venus doubles match. Now, generally, the doubles matches don't get a whole lot of love. People aren't really interested in the doubles match. But since this is Serena's last go-round, now at 40 years old, so what's that make Venus, like 43?
Close, but she says she still wants to play a little bit.
Because, you know, Venus is a little older than Serena.
She did not help Serena at all last night, if you watched any of the match.
No, and she has a big old brace on her knee, too.
But she just looked really rough and rusty in terms of a lot of her returns and even her serves. And they haven't played doubles in, I think, 4 years.
It's been a little while, yeah.
Yeah.
4 years is the right number. It's been a little while.
I just want to make sure that, you know, Largo knows as a tennis aficionado, I know my stats. So I just want to make sure I got that out there.
They played the Czech team last night with a couple of names that Radeka and Noskova, I think I'm saying those correctly. But they lost. They lost in straight sets, 7-6, 6-4. But this is what it sounded like when they walked off the court.
Well, listen, 4.5 years without playing a match with each other, even if you're sisters, that's a tough assignment. What a fun match, though. Straight sets to the Czechs.
Yes, no, that was a lot of fun, and the Czechs really played well.
Still, what a treat to see Venus and Serena, 14-time major winners. Standing ovation for Venus and Serena. Serena will be back out here at singles tomorrow night.
See, that's where I'm at. Look, it was the first set was extremely close. It was a 7-6 first set. And it wasn't like they got their doors blown off. Even when it looked like they were going to get run in the second set, they made a nice comeback. They had opportunities. But I continued to tell you this even yesterday. My bigger concern was I questioned whether she should be doing this or not simply because you can't predict what she was going to do in the future in terms of advancing as far as she's already gotten. But I'd like to have seen her have the night off last night to rest so that she's ready to go again tonight, because it is a quicker turnaround than I had thought, and she's not going to get a full day off. But, you know, she knows her body best, and she knows what she's doing. So you just got to believe and support that she's going to be out there 100%, and she's going to give it a go tonight. But I've really thoroughly enjoyed watching this run. And I'm very much, for one, I'm hopeful that it is historic, that she does make a hell of a run. Her side of the draw has really kind of opened up now to where she's not going to play anybody seated tonight. So you hope she has an opportunity to keep this thing going.
And look, it's the end of an era, right? This is the last time we're ever going to see the Williams sisters play together, real period, on anything, professional tennis. And monster crowd. Absolutely packed. We've talked about the type of people who have been at these crowds, all the celebrities who have been there. Billie Jean King in attendance, right? One of the original trailblazers of women's tennis. Adam Silver, commissioner of the NBA, was there.
Well, I didn't see him.
The editor of Vogue, Anna Wintour, she is right there in the front. There are a lot of who's who.
Spike Lee's there every night. Tiger the other night.
Every night. And the idea of having doubles, prime time, Arthur Ashe center court, that doesn't happen.
But they broke away from football for that?
Apparently they broke away from a football game to move this match to the primary ESPN channel.
Oof. Wow, I can understand her singles match too, but I guess. I mean, it's all part of the run, but yeah, that's kind of hard for me to believe that they would go to that level. I found it perfectly on, I think it was the ESPN News channel, but it was not that big, or the Deuce, one or the other, but it wasn't that big of a deal. I was going back and forth between the Pitt West Virginia game and the tennis match.
I think it tells you how much traction, how much interest there is And look, this is Serena's last go. Now, the other day, when after her first match, and she won, and they put up the video tribute, almost like it seemed that they didn't know if Serena was going to win or not. So they planned all this stuff for day one, and the house is packed, and it's a who's who of celebrities. And you had said, why does everybody just assume that Serena Williams is going to lose to some unranked, unheard of nobody, like first round? Like, why do we think, why are they acting like this was going to be potentially a match she was going to lose? Apparently, Stephen A. Had a take on this same thing, very much echoed what you had to say.
Here's what I don't understand. I mean, this is a 23-time singles champion. And one of the things that actually annoyed me about Wednesday night, it was like everyone came to say goodbye. Like, oh, we're here because she's going to lose tonight. Mm-hmm. I'm like, it's the 80th ranked player in the world. I don't care who it is. Serena ain't losing to her, especially for her swan song. This is it. She's letting everything hang out. Are you seeing anything in her game right now that's reminiscent of what she's done in the past when she's been at her best, considering the fact that this is it. This is for all the marbles before she walks away.
Man, I saw that yesterday, and I was like, that is basically exactly what Joel said the other day.
Yeah. I mean, look, and the thing was, then they doubled down after she eliminates the two seed, and they played the Oprah video again. Only this time, thank God for all of us, they didn't have Gail King doing the post-match interviews. They had Mary Jo Fernandez. But at a certain point, if I'm Serena, I'd be like, hey, can we table this until it's all said and done and just let me handle my business? Because it gets to be a distraction. And then she's on the court for an extended period of time, way past when the match is over. The first time they did it, she then eventually got onto a stationary bike and was still doing even more work post-match before she did her press, before she did everything else. I think as she continues to progress here, and I hope if she wins tonight, they don't do it yet again, because I think a lot of competitors, and we've seen how kind of, and I'm looking, crotchety starting pitchers can be on their day that they're pitching, regardless of what the accolades are. Kobe used to be that way, but Kobe kind of relented when he knew it was over and there was nothing on the line because they weren't going to make the playoffs. But I think as it relates to her, as it will relate to like a Tiger Woods, if they're mid-tournament or they're doing something, their focus is going to be, wait till I'm done, and then we can have the quote-unquote fun and look back in history and reminisce. If I'm her, I would say, okay, enough is enough. We got it out of the way. Because I was saying it for a reason. I didn't understand it. She's still the greatest of all time, and she's still got something left in the tank. Whether she won it or not, I get all it said to me was that people at the U.S. Open were thinking this isn't going to be a very long run, and we better capitalize it before she's done.
Like they were worried. Yeah. We have to get it all out of the way now, just in case. And I'm interested to see. She plays, I think she plays today. When she plays her third round match today, are they going to do it again? Are they going to do it for every crowd that comes in to see her?
I hope not. I think that if you truly want to see her make a good long run and continue to do this, stop doing that. There'll be a time for that when all is over with.
There was a report, they got 5 million viewers,
I believe,
for
it.
Serena's last singles match. 5 million viewers. That's a big number for tennis.
Everyone was talking about it on social media, reminding people it was going on. People were commenting on the commentary. People were ripping Chrissy Evert, a new one, for her clueless commentary in some regards. But yeah, look, I mean, it's close to must-see TV right now.
You know, it's funny because when I was a kid, Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova were huge rivals. Mm-hmm. And Martina was always kind of painted as the bad guy by the media because, you know, she's obviously not originally from the States. She ultimately emigrated here. And, you know, Chris Evert was the all-American girl. And they would always structure the broadcast to be pro-Chris Evert, kind of anti-Martina. And Chris Evert had the endorsements and Martina didn't. And that's just how it went. They both won 18 majors, which, I mean, that's a monster number. But you look at where we are now 40 years later. And today, Martina is the one who's looked at as the one who is more in touch with the current game, more in touch with the current climate. And Chris Evert is the one who's kind of looked at as out of touch, says wacky stuff, not really in touch with the game or the players or whatnot. They have gone full circle on the way that Martina and Chris Evert have been treated and portrayed in the media.
Well, and I think that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, and Largo can too because he's a tennis expert. If you look at anybody that has any kind of argument, and I believe that Mad Dog was the first one, of course, because he's so old school, to go with the fact that there's somebody else that's the greatest of all time, not named Serena Williams. I think the first name out of anybody's mouth when they think that there's somebody else is Martina Navratilova, because she had a run for an extended period of time. She was number one for an extended period of time. The way she won majors, the way she won tournaments, the way she went about her business, even like you said, in those matchups with Chris Evert and others, she was dominant. And so I think she's one of the first names that everybody would mention in terms of there are several greatest of all times, much like when you're getting in LeBron and Jordan and who's the greatest in the NBA. But, you know, you never want to forget the legends of the past, but you definitely want to appreciate what you're seeing right now, because in our lifetime, you're seeing the greatest women's tennis player that you probably have ever seen and will ever see.
I think will ever see is probably accurate. All right, coming up next. So he's definitely playing today, right? Killer Bees.
All teams covered. No talking points necessary. You're back with the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Well, Joe, this is, you know, probably the biggest thing to look for in the lineup tonight with the Houston Astros. Will he or won't he play? Will Yordan Alvarez be in the lineup? Now, he's missed three straight games. They've had two off days. So, essentially, he's had 5 days off now to recover from some hand soreness and feel a little better. And while James Click did say, you know, hey, it's possible he'd be available on Wednesday, he didn't play. Yordan had said he's been able to do everything. He's, you know, been kind of playing through the soreness for a couple of weeks, and they decided, hey, let's get these off days, let's give a little time to rest. And, you know, he said from July it was his right hand. This time he said it's just one hand. I saw somebody said it was both hands. It's just one. They asked him if it was the left hand or the right hand, and he said just one. She's not telling. Which I'm sure he was instructed not to say anything. Dusty got a little salty with the media when they were asking about Alvarez before Wednesday's game, and he's like, "You already know how he is. Why are you guys asking me?" It's like, "You want to know what to write? Write what he told you." So Dusty getting a little salty and having a little fun with the media. But Yordan, who his poor August, where he only had 4 extra base hits and 102 plate appearances, actually knocked his OPS down below 1,000 for the first time all year to 995. But will Yordan play tonight? He says he's going to play. I think, and we talked about this a little earlier, but I think he should be written in as the DH every time he is in the lineup. He should not see the field in any way, shape, or form.
I mean, there should be kid gloves. I mean, when you think about this, and to put it in the right perspective from you looking at it from a team standpoint, you got a guy that had knee issues a few years ago, so much so that he had to have procedures to make sure that they were rectified, and then there was a big concern about where his legs were going to be for the rest of his career. Now you got a guy that we're talking about the same kind of thing with both hands. It was the right one before. It's the left one now. It doesn't matter what he tells you or Dusty tells you. You've seen enough to realize he's had issues with both of his hands and how important that is to hitting the baseball. And the fact that, as you mentioned, when his power numbers go completely off the rails the wrong direction – but yet when you look at his statistics, as they rate to Aaron Judge's MVP season, you realize he's almost second in every other category, and he's missed significant time with the injuries that he's had. He is a massive player, and not just in appearance and stature, but in every shape and form of offensively what he means to this team. So just make sure that it's not about whether he plays or not tonight, though it would be a positive message for fans. But if he doesn't feel 100%, if he doesn't feel like he's getting better and has made significant progress in his health, he shouldn't be in the lineup tonight. You've got guys that can pick up the pieces and guys that can fill in. And more importantly, you can buy the time because of the games you're up on the Yankees and Mariners. You don't need to force him back in the lineup. And sometimes, like Verlander, you need to take him out of the way of himself. and realize he wants to play to let everybody know he's okay. But if he's not 100%, don't put him out there.
No, and if he can't play tonight, put him on the IL, backdate him, because you can backdate it now 6 days. And, you know, basically at that point, it's you're sitting him for another 4 days. It's not like you've got him on a long-term thing. But if he can't play tonight, there's no reason not to put him on the 10-day. Just to, hey, you know what, here, you'll have a week and a half off, and then let's see how you feel.
Well, it's once again, get him out of his own way. Keep him from himself.
It's way more important for him to be healthy September 20th than September 2nd.
Yeah, look, that's the thing. I mean, if he's not going to do it himself and realize, I'm not 100%, I probably need another day or two, I'm going to play this smart, then it's the franchise's duty, whether it be the general manager or the coaching staff, to come in and just say, hey, we know you really want to play, and we love that about you, but there's nothing to play for, and the only thing that can happen here, if you're still dealing with any kind of soreness and pain in that area, you can only do more damage if you go out there too soon, too quickly, and re-aggravate it, because now you're starting from scratch again with trying to do the rehab process. So don't push it. And if the IL is the way to basically get him to do what he's not willing to do and sit one out and sit a series out, sit another series out. You got nothing to play for against the Angels.
So we agree on how they really should be handling Yordan. How would you handle Justin Verlander the rest of the way once he comes back off the IL?
How am I handling Verlander would be determined upon that calf muscle and how it's reacting. If he feels like it's 100%, and he feels like, look, he's going to have missed enough time to where you're not going to be as worried about how many innings he's logged on that Tommy John repaired arm this year. So, again, you got him out of his own way. He was the one that was pushing for the five-man rotation. He was the man pushing to get him back up to 100 pitches. He was pushing himself no matter what the Astros plan said he should be on in terms of where he should be milestone-wise with the arm and innings and pitches. So you got him out of his own way by putting him on the IL, by making sure he missed a couple of starts, by making sure that no matter what happens because it was a leg injury that his arm got a chance to kind of rest. You got him out of his own way, did what you needed to do to make sure that he's going to hopefully be at his best. But now you're not rushing him back either. Now, screw all this talk about the no-hitter the last time around and all the things he was doing previous to this start where he got hurt. This is about making sure that he gradually ramps up so that when you get ready to start the playoffs, he's where he needs to be. You don't throw him back out there and literally throw him there for seven innings and 100 close two pitches and say, that's what we got to see immediately from Justin Verlander. No, you don't. You've already seen that, been there, done that, and he's already proven to you who he is. Now, just get him back in the swing of things gradually and ramp him back up so that he can be who you need him to be for the playoffs.
Yeah. Now, look, I believe a player of Verlander's stature deserves to have a certain amount of say in what goes on with him. But as far as his return to the field, I'm not giving him a whole lot of say there. I got to see a bullpen. I got to see a sim game before he goes back onto the mound in a game. And his first time out in the game, I might not let him throw more than 80 pitches.
Yeah.
Because I got to make sure that, you know, when he says, oh, yeah, my calf is fine, that his calf is really fine, not my calf. I think my calf is fine, so I'm going to push it really hard, and then, ow, crap, I hurt it again. So, first time out, maybe he goes, 80 pitches. I don't think I would want to let Verlander go more than six innings in any start here between now and the end of the season, just because I don't need him to do it. All I need him to do is be healthy.
Before you even do the simulated game, he needs to be doing nothing but PFPs. He just needs to do pitcher's fielding. He just needs to make sure he's fielding bunts. He's covering first base. He's changing directions. That's the most important thing. Make sure the calf's right first, then get into a simulated game, and then handle him with kid gloves, getting him ready for the end of the regular season. Like you said, 80 pitches or less, fine. Doesn't matter who you're playing. Doesn't matter where the game's at when he hits that kind of threshold. He's going out of the game. He needs to understand that. I don't care if he's throwing a no-no. I don't care if his pitch count is low. I just need to, what I care about most is his health.
No, and now that I've got multiple guys in my bullpen that I can get multiple innings from, if Verlander only goes five innings, then fine. Then I'm going to go to one of those guys who can give me multiple innings out of the pen, whether that's a Brandon Belak, a Seth Martinez, a Christian Javier, whomever it is. Those are the guys I'm looking to go to, you know, save my bullpen, save my shorter-term guys, because, you know, I know I'm going to need a few more for Verlander, especially now that you go on the five-man rotation. So if they're not going to go back to a six-man, I'm limiting the amount of workload that Justin Verlander's going to have the rest of the season, because if he can get through the rest of the season and the calf is not an issue, I'm going to turn him loose in that first round of the playoffs and be like, okay, you want to go 7, go 8? Here you go. Ball is yours. So that's where I need him.
Yeah, and that's what you should. That's where you should be at. And at the same time, you are analyzing your bullpen on a daily basis. So you need to, again, this is the perfect scenario where a lot of times I've mentioned in this stretch run, a lot of things have sorted themselves out, whether it be through injury or otherwise, to where center field has really sorted itself out, when it was really congested with three guys, and you knew Click was pushing Jake, and you knew that Dusty didn't like Chaz, and you knew that if Dusty didn't like Chaz, he really liked Dubon, and it sorted itself out. Diaz got hurt again, so left field sorted itself out, where whether Dusty liked it or not, Trey Mancini got where we always wanted him to go that I was harping on, and let's get him reps in left field. So these things are, you know, now that Machete is hurt, it's given an even better opportunity for Vasquez to prove he should be the number one, and we'll see how that plays out, but you're in a good position there as well. Yuli's hitting the ball better, and I got him out of the two hole. So everything's sorting itself out. The bullpen has to sort itself out. You've got to figure out who's going to be in, who's going to be out, and how effective they're going to be, and the roles they're going to play. Because Presley's got to get back here pretty soon, too, now, and then you got to get him enough reps to make sure he's going to be okay.
And he's never seen the field back-to-back days in the regular season. Period, the end.
The rest of the regular season.
Rest of the regular season. Presley does not go back-to-back rest of the regular season.
Late in the end of the schedule, I think you need to. Just the same way I said, you got to ramp up Verlander so that his pitch count and everything is more in tune with what he's going to throw in the playoffs. Presley's going to have these opportunities with the way the schedule lays out where you're going to need him back-to-back games. So not right away, kind of like you said with the pitch count on JV, 80 or less. I'm not going to do it right away to Presley, but at a certain point later in the end of the regular season, I am going to do it because I'm going to need him to do that in the playoffs.
I will be open to it last week of the season that you give him one or two shots to do it because you know you're going to have a little off time in between the end of the season and the start of that first round because they're going to have to get through that wild card stuff first. So, and that's like last week of the season if we're going to do that. Coming up next, a Texans rival suffers a big blow yesterday. Killer Bees.
Independent thinking, unrestricted opinions. You're tuned in to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
So, Joel, we've talked about, you know, the Texans, the upcoming season, and, you know, what your expectations are. How many wins do you think they could realistically get? And, you know, like, what would be the ceiling for them if, you know, everything broke right for them and maybe things break wrong for some of the other teams in their division? Well, the Tennessee Titans had something break horribly wrong yesterday. Harold Landry tore his ACL in practice on Wednesday, according to Adam Schefter. He led the team with 12 sacks last season, 7 of which came on third down. He was a big part of their three-headed monster rushing the passer. Marcus Spears on ESPN broke down what the loss really means for the Titans here.
This was a part. Harold Landry was a part of the unit that I thought was going to be the heartbeat for the Tennessee Titans. And the unit that was literally going to dictate how their season went, him along with Jeffrey Simmons and Danico Autry and those guys all playing together along with Bud. But now you lose a major piece. And y'all know how I talk about this, and I'll talk about it as the season goes along. This is a league now where you need closers. And Harold Landry is a closer when you get in those third, fourth quarter situations where you got to get off the field. Huge loss for the Titans.
It was definitely a big loss.
We've seen firsthand. When you lose a big pass rusher, they are almost impossible to replace.
No doubt about it. But I think that, you know what, the one thing that I'm going to be grateful for when we start getting the regular season football is the fact that everybody isn't starting from scratch. And after week one, you will truly see who teams really are. Because across the league, you got Jacksonville Jaguar fans talking about shocking the world, and they're going to sweep the Texans, and they're going to sweep the Colts, and they're going to win the division, and they're going to be 11-6. Stop it already, okay? This is a significant injury because this is a significant team. It isn't Jacksonville. It isn't the Jets. It isn't the Lions. It isn't the Texans, in my opinion. It's a team that was there a year ago, and unfortunately or fortunately, but Ryan Tannehill's performance in part, and then an injured and dinged up Derrick Henry that wasn't 100% himself, didn't get them where they needed to go. But they're very talented, and part of it is because their defense was dominant. And their defense is going to be less dominant now because of this injury, and it's something that everybody's going to take note of, because whether you think they can try and replace him or make a trade now or do something in the short term to try and, you know, cover up for the injury or not, there's a guy that was dominant that might not be you might not be capable of replacing.
It's a big blow for their defense, and I will tell you that I hope that the Titans hover around, you know, they're at 500 and maybe a game over, that they play well enough to be in the hunt, because as long as, you know, Ryan Tannehill is the quarterback, it's a beatable team.
It is, but if Derrick Henry's 100%, he can beat you down, and if he's getting his yards, you don't have to see a whole lot of Ryan Tannehill.
No, but I am looking at it from the Tannehill versus Malik Willis point of view. Man, Malik Willis is going to be a player.
I totally believe that too, and it was shocking to me how far he slid, because I do believe he is going to be a player, but you don't want to see that this year.
Oh, no.
You can't afford to do that. And I think that the one thing that you can say on top of what I said, which was how dominant their defense was and how their defense kept them in games and in some cases won them games by keeping them from having to see too much of Ryan Tannehill, losing an A.J. Brown is going to be a big deal for them, because expecting a rookie, no matter how highly touted he was, to come in and suddenly take the reins and just make it a smooth transition from A.J. Brown, it's not going to happen. And when you have a quarterback, and we talk about all these quarterbacks that make receivers better, that can throw guys open, and you can go down the list of the guys in the league that can do this, Ryan Tannehill is never in those discussions. And it's for a reason. So therefore, they've got a lot more to prove offensively than they do defensively until you suffer an injury like this, because now you've got worries on defense too.
Now, also happening yesterday, Russell Wilson got paid. Here's George Payton, the Broncos general manager, discussing why this was. They talk about why is this the right time to have this new deal for Russell Wilson?
Now is the right time just to, you know, eliminate any distractions, you know, during the season or after the season. It's just, you know, it was just great for him and for us just to get it done. So you're not thinking about it, you know, during the season and next week. And so now it's over and we can move on to Seattle.
Did you think there was going to be some kind of a distraction if Russ didn't get another new contract? He gets a 5-year extension up to $245 million, $165 million guaranteed. So that's essentially $33 million a year guaranteed, potential of up to $49 million guaranteed. Does this put the Broncos essentially back in Manning mode of, hey, we need to win, we need to lead right this second, we are all in chips right now?
Well, this is more cover your ass mode. You've got new ownership coming in with, you know, with the Bolin family selling. You've got the never-ending story of the Broncos can be as good as they want defensively and have a Super Bowl caliber defense and have, you know, a stockpile of young offensive weapons that they kept drafting. But they, you know, that's why John Elway isn't the general manager anymore. They could not get it right with a quarterback. And this is the cover your ass of, we tried and tried and tried. Now that we got the guy that we wanted to get that's more of a franchise quarterback, we're going to lock him up, for, in my personal opinion, far too much for far too long. Because Russell Wilson, to me, when they said he was 33, I was like, wait, what? He plays and looks like he's far older than that. And a lot of it goes back to the pattern that you've seen with Russ over his career, which was also a surprise to me when I saw that stat. He has never finished in the top two or three in MVP voting. But how many times can we say for the first 8 weeks of the season, he was the leader in the clubhouse for MVP? And then he just falls off. And as you mentioned when we were talking about it during the break, he's also been dinged up quite a bit in the last couple of years, which is not a good sign. As you get older and you're getting hurt more and you're getting more dinged up, there's less reason to give him more years and more money like the Broncos just did.
No, and that's, you know, kind of the book on Russ is he's going to get off to a great start, then he's going to get hurt, then it's going to slow down, then he tries to ramp it up again at the end of the year, and hopefully it's in time. Here's Russ on why he decided he wants to stay in Denver.
George Payton, obviously, George, I thank you for, you know, believing in me. I thank you for making all this happen, you know, just your hard work, your vision, the team that you've assembled to as well and put together has been really amazing. And, you know, the reason why I wanted to be here for so long, because I trust you two guys up on the stage with me. You know, I trust you, Coach Hackett, and how you're going to go about it, how you've gone about it every single day, the work that you put in, the late nights, and then you, George, too, as well. You know, your vision and just how you're such an amazing communicator, just how we've communicated, all three, you know, the three of us, how you've communicated along this whole process about details and about young guys and about the vets and about what you want to do next and everything else. That means a lot to me because I love this game. You know, I'm wildly obsessed about this game, and I'm obsessed with it. And I think that when you get to be around people that have that same obsession, it makes it that much more special.
I don't know what you heard, but I heard cheese and butter.
He got a lot of J.J. Watt in him. He could sell you sand at the beach. I mean, he is the ultimate positive salesman. Just like J.J. sold the crap out of the fact that he was, you know, when from day one wearing Rockets jerseys and Astros hats and talking about, you know, Houston this and every team that he loves and support, you know, and then his teammates and his coaching staff. These guys, man, they are the ultimates. But and don't tell me the coincidences, they both went to Wisconsin. But I look at it and I go, man, look, you're supposed to say those things. You know what he really is telling you? Skip Nathaniel Hackett. Skip George and what he's done as a general manager. Look flat down at that bottom line and go, this is what won me over. This is what convinced me this is where I need to be. Because Seattle wasn't giving him that deal. Seattle wasn't interested in doing all that when they know they're in the middle of a rebuild. But because this team not only went out and got him and gave up a decent package to get him, but if they're going to throw that kind of money at you too to make sure that they keep you, yeah, that's the face I want to be. I love these guys.
Nah, cheese and butter, right? He's cheesy as hell, and he's trying to butter up his bosses.
Yeah.
And much you said about, hey, there's a bottom line here that I really like those numbers. But then Russ tried to tell us this isn't about the money.
To me, what it's really about is being able to win championships and being able to have enough space in the salary cap so George can make his magic and we can get guys like Randy Gregory when he comes on the team or other great players, you know. And I think that we want to make this a destination location. I think that it's one of those things we have amazing tradition, an amazing football team. For me, it wasn't really about, you know, how much necessarily. It was about how many Super Bowls we can win. And that's really the focus.
I mean, maybe the focus should be a better microphone and audio-visual system for when you're doing a press conference of that magnitude, Broncos.
Tell me lies. Tell me sweet little lies.
Oh, Fleetwood
Mac. It's always about the money.
Yeah. Did you not hear the pops and the bad audio? Let's focus on that first. If we want to be a first-class organization, let's not use a third-class audio system.
If it's not about the money, then okay, fine. Sign for $20 million.
Creighton, I'm talking to you. Look. I say it again. He can sell it and spin it and, you know, slap it down, flip it, rub it down, however he wants to put it into context that he wants us to believe. At the end of the line, it's the bottom line. That's all it's about.
And it would also help if he knew to stay away from the microphone, just like, you know, like a foot or so that you're not right.
Mic screen would help. Yeah. Audio system could be better. I rest my case.
A little better. B-Mac, you're going to have to head out to Denver and teach these guys how to engineer a studio.
I think that's more than a one-day course.
Yeah, without question. Well, I don't miss those days either because I'd be the one catching the heat for that on a Rockets press conference, and then I'd have all the different stations in town barking and complaining and whining because they got to go live and we didn't, and they got a better location and we didn't than we got, and our line sucked, and we couldn't do that. Shut up.
Why is there a hum in the malt box?
I don't miss any of that.
Coming up next, is this a setback for one school or for a whole movement? Killer Bees.
Your team's our priority. Join the conversation with the Killer Bees. Now coming to you live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios. Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
All right, about 15 minutes, it'll be time for Who Said It. So if you want to take on Joel and I in Who Said It for a chance to win a $25 gift card to the Waffle Bus. See, we're giving out gift cards for food now. Get a chance to win a $25 gift card for the Waffle Bus. Take on Joel and I in Who Said It. 713-780-3776. 713-780-ESPN. Get in on it now. Secure your spot.
Did we win last week? We did, right?
Yes. Well, I'm going to say you won. B because
no,
I was
it was still a team effort.
I
carried you the way I carry Branham every week that we win.
And I got to be a lot harder to carry because, you know, I don't fiddle over your shoulder as well as Jeremy does. But
if you guys want to go at it mano a mano, I'll referee.
This something that's look. This is a really awful story. What's going on in Jackson, Mississippi? The entire city
got that right.
Doesn't have just clean running water. They can't brush their teeth, let alone drink the water. It is the whole filtration system is dead for the biggest city in Mississippi. It's crazy. And as a result, you know, Deion Sanders, head coach Jackson State, he's having to take extraordinary measures to try to take care of his players. Here's Deion talking about the crisis at Jackson State.
Look, crisis, the city of Jackson, we don't have water. Water means we don't have air conditioning. We can't use toilets. We don't have water. Therefore, we don't have ice. Places a burden on the program. So right now, we're operating in crisis mode. I got to get these kids off campus, the ones that live on campus, the one that lives in the city of Jackson, into a hotel and accommodate them, make sure all our kids are fed, and all our kids have the necessities of life until this crisis resides. So we're going to find somewhere to practice, find somewhere that can accommodate every darn thing that we need and desire to be who we desire to be, and that's dominant. The devil is a lie. You ain't going to get us today, baby.
Deion taking it on himself to basically take care of his entire team. A, Deion, everywhere he's been, he's always been a leader, but he has means most other people don't have. And using those means to take care of his kids, because right now the entire city of Jackson is in crisis.
Let's be realistic, though. And as much as kudos that you just gave out to Deion are deserving, it's a bigger issue than the football team. We're talking about the entire city. We're talking about the fact that this morning at City Hall, they had a massive water drive going on with trucks ready to load up and pull out and head to Jackson as quick as possible to get them bottled water and all the water that they could possibly donate, because of the fact that this is a real problem. It's not about a football team being able to play football games. It's about a city and people being able to function. And so I certainly hope he's able to do what he needs to do for his football team, but I hope there's him and others that are also trying to put their resources together to do what needs to be done for the city of Jackson, because it's a mess. And when you think about it, like just fundament the structure and the cost that's the infrastructure and what it's going to cost to try and fix and rectify this ancient water system that they have, we're not talking about millions. We're talking about like a billion. It's going to be unbelievable financial burden to try and get them out of this hole that they got going on right now.
There's a lot of questions going on in Mississippi right now, because apparently they've received hundreds of millions of dollars for infrastructure repairs over the last several years, yet no repairs to this infrastructure in Jackson have been made. And notably, maybe the most famous person in Mississippi,
you saw this story,
has not actually, you know, said anything or tried to help, but he did get about $8 million for speeches he never gave, paid out of the welfare fund from Mississippi, of which at some point he had to give $1 million back.
Well, he still owes $227,000 in interest. So Brett Favre,
he doesn't have enough money.
Brett Favre, yeah, who's not shy on funds. But the welfare fund and all the different money that had been raised by, I think it's now the previous governor, but the governor and others are now being examined and investigated all over the place. Because his alma mater, that being Favre of Southern Miss, got a $5 million volleyball facility while his daughter was coincidentally playing volleyball there.
No.
And
it had to be a coincidence.
It's rumored, it's believed that the financing for that came from government, came out of the budget to help low-income people that needed the money the most. So the whole state is a mess right now, not just because of the weather and the flooding and everything that's going on that we talked about with the water system in Jackson. The whole state is a freaking joke that's being investigated, that's on every nightly news show in America. And Brett Favre's in the middle of it. Yeah, he got $1 million for 3 speaking engagements. He never made the speeches. When they found out about it, he said he paid back. And then they said, oh, by the way, you still owe us $227,000 in interest, which he has yet to pay back.
Gibbs rule number 39. There is no such thing as a coincidence.
There you have it. Well, innocent until proven guilty, though, Pat. So we have to at least, you know, say that to make sure, hey, let justice take its course and let it play out.
No, only till proven guilty in a court of law. You could still be guilty and just not be guilty in a court of law. But, you know, the fact that, I mean, we went through this as a country. We saw this go down in Flint, Michigan, where the water system wasn't taken care of. The pipes were full of lead. People were getting sick. People were dying. Now we have in Jackson, Mississippi, an entire water filtration system for an entire city just shut down. Fail. The plant has failed. They don't have. Could you imagine you can't even brush your teeth?
Can't shower.
I mean, you know. Just take them back to the 1700s and everything is going to be, you know, go outside, boil the water from the river, use the outhouse. Where are we living?
Well, and look, not to make it too much about non-sports, but when you look at what's gone on in Flint, Michigan for the last several years and how bad that water system is and all the issues that they've had, and they didn't have a natural disaster. They didn't have flooding. They didn't have any of that. They just started to figure out real quick they don't have a proper water structure in place that can provide you, which you would think is what everybody is entitled to every day, which is clean running water. So, and when they start talking about what it's going to take to redo these systems, it ain't peanuts and it ain't pennies. It's a lot of money.
Now, look, this obviously is probably going to be a setback for Jackson State because you can't get on campus, which means they're not going to have normal practices. They're not going to be able to prepare for their classes the right way. I wouldn't be surprised if the team struggles a bit this year. I wouldn't be surprised if there's kids who wind up academically ineligible because, I mean, they're not on campus with everything going on. Maybe they're going to have trouble keeping up with some of their schoolwork. But because this HBCU movement of kids choosing HBCUs instead of the big Power Five teams, so much of that is dependent on Deion Sanders. So much of that is dependent on what he's doing, you know, the establishment that he is creating, you know, the lines that he is setting.
The salaries in some cases that he's personally paying.
If Jackson State falters this year, does it hurt the entire movement?
It does slow it down. It definitely hurts it. It doesn't stop it, but it hurts it because they've gotten traction. And you're right. Deion is at the forefront of a lot of it. Look, he hired Mike Zimmer to be his defensive coordinator. I mean, the former coach of the Minnesota Vikings last season, one of the better defensive coordinators in the league over the last 10 years. And whatever Mike Zimmer wasn't able to make, I think Deion basically supplemented it to make sure he'd go there and do that because he knows how important it is right now and the statement they could make. You can obviously say, look, you can point the finger as to the reasons why if it doesn't go well this year, and everybody would be forgiving. But because you have all this momentum, that's the value you want to capitalize on. That's the big wheel you want to keep turning because that's where you've got more and more people to pay attention and get involved and be engaged and be aware that you might lose in the shuffle if he does have a bad year.
And that, to me, that's the greater unintended consequence of things that are going on. All right, coming up next, who said it? 713-780-3776.
Who wants to play? Who wants to lose?
Who wants to get a $25 gift card to the Waffle Bus? All you have to do is take down Joel and I. And who said it? We'll get to it next.